You're listening to Mr. Open Banking, the only podcast dedicated to exploring the open banking movement. Whether you're a financial expert, banking executive, or everyday consumer, open banking affects everyone and will change the way we interact with our money. I'm A.L. Savan, your host. This episode is brought to you by FData, the Financial Data and Technology Association, advocating for open finance across North America and around the world. For the past several years, the American open banking story has been dominated by four little numbers. 1033. This numeric call sign refers to a clause, a section, in the Dodd-Frank Consumer Protection Act, a law passed in response to the 2008 financial crisis. On the page, Section 1033 is just a few sparse lines, simply directing financial institutions, like banks, to give consumers their financial information when they ask for it. But in our increasingly digital world, where your financial life is scattered across a constellation of providers, that seemingly simple command has become a fault line, splitting the industry and forcing a debate that will shape the future of open banking in America. On October 22, 2024, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or CFPB, used Section 1033 as the basis for their new Personal Financial Data Rights Rule, which stretched a few paragraphs from Dodd-Frank into a 700-page opus, finally defining standards and practices for how consumers' financial data must be shared. On the day of its release, the rule was immediately challenged in court. Astute listeners will remember that something else was happening in late 2024. The U.S. presidential election was drawing to a close. So it was already clear to those in open banking circles that the fate of the newly minted Section 1033 rule would hang on the results of the election. The story that unfolded following the re-election of Donald Trump features regulators under threat, bold interventions, market-changing maneuvers, whiplash course corrections, and a court case that aims to finally determine the rules for how consumers will share their data. That is the story we are here to tell. On this episode, recorded live at Money 2020 in Las Vegas late last year, I speak to two people who find themselves on either side of the great debate that has come to surround Section 1033. They are rivals, not just in the boardroom or even in the press, but in the actual legal case still before the courts today. On Mr. Open Banking, live. You're listening to Mr. Open Banking, the only podcast dedicated to exploring the evolution of open banking around the world. I'm your host, A.L. Savan, broadcasting live from Las Vegas as part of the Money Pot exhibit at the world's premier fintech event, Money 2020. For this session, I'm joined by two guests who are on either side of what is perhaps the single most important open banking debate anywhere on Earth. The battle over Section 1033, the infamous U.S. regulation that aims to enshrine for Americans the right to access and share their financial data. Since its introduction late last year, 1033 has ignited fierce controversy in the press, in the courts, and throughout the industry. And my two guests have found themselves holding the banners for the two rival factions. Penny Lee, is the president and CEO of the Financial Technology Association, or FTA, and John Court is an EVP and general counsel at the Bank Policy Institute, or BPI. Penny, John, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
Likewise. Thanks for having us.
Let's begin. Section 1033 of the Dodd-Frank Act was enacted all the way back in 2010, giving consumers the right to access their financial information. 14 years later, on October 22, 2024, the CFPB released the final version of their Section 1033 rule under the name Personal Financial Data Rights, the first ever U.S. open banking regulation. By way of introduction, how were your two organizations involved in the run-up to the rule, and what happened on the day of the rule's release?
Sure. Let me just step back real quick. Financial Technology Association was founded or launched in March of 2021. So a relatively new trade association representing financial technology companies, digitally native, as we like to say. And this issue of data portability, who owns the data, the right to permission this data, has been an issue that we have known to be part of the Dodd-Frank Act for many years. And it has come and gone, and it has had iterations as far as rulemaking initiated with the Trump administration, what they call an ANPR, and kind of laying out what this section should say. And then Joe Biden, when he became president, picked it up again and started to go through the what we would call the formal rulemaking. So when we were launched in 2021, this was an issue for us, central to all of fintech, that ability to be able to use and for consumers to be able to permission their data to use the financial tools which they want to. So that's our initial foray. We were obviously active. We delivered comments through all the stages of the rulemaking process. And then I can stop here and kind of tell you what happened that day, because there's some funny stories about what was happening that day when it was announced and finalized. But leading up to it, we had been engaged. We had participated throughout the whole rulemaking process to ensure that the right for the consumers to own and protect and share their data was solidified in their final rule.
Sure. And at the Bank Policy Institute, we have been around since 2018, but our roots in a legacy organization go back to the 1860s to the Clearinghouse Association. So we have been involved in the payments ecosystem for over 150 years. But with respect to this particular provision, as you point out, it's Section 1033 of the Dodd-Frank Act. That act was enacted in 2010, largely a set of measures designed to respond to the global financial crisis. And at BPI, we are involved in all range of prudential and consumer policy matters. So we've been involved in this one since it sort of started to take off. But interestingly, it didn't sort of start to take off until 2020, 2021. I think when it was written into the law in 2010, my recollection at least, and I think the predominant view, although I'm happy to be challenged, is that these provisions were largely designed to ensure that consumers or customers could quote unquote fire their bank. The understanding at the time was people would say, oh, I'm not happy with my bank. And people would say, oh, well, why don't you move? And they say, well, it's too much trouble. You know, I've got all my bill pay set up. It's just too much trouble. So I think this provision was largely designed to address that concern. And it's a pretty limited provision. It's not very long at all. And more or less just says that banks should deliver to their consumers their information, basically, so they can go take that information to another bank. And so, you know, from 2010 to 2020, there's basically no action on this statutory provision, right? And in fact, in 2010, there was no real data sharing ecosystem the way there is today. And that ecosystem actually didn't start to build and develop until 2014, 2015, 2016. I think in 2014, you saw Plaid was launched as a company for the first time, probably one of the most preeminent data broker, data middlemen in the marketplace today. And so it wasn't until Rohit Chopra, I think, came into the CFPB in 2020, 2021, and adopted what I think was a very ambitious project to look at Section 1033 and reimagine it in the current marketplace and promulgate a rule that, in his view, was designed to help regulate the marketplace. And we've been involved in that process since its inception in 2020, 2021.
Okay. don't keep us in suspense. What happened on the day? John, I think you might be the man to answer.
Oh, sure. And by the way, so I think we're going to talk about what happened on the day of the rule, which is the rule was announced and BPI, along with some co-plaintiffs, brought a litigation challenging the rule. And some people sort of perceive that negatively, right? Like, oh, you sued to block this rule. And it's like, yes, we sued to block the rule. We, on behalf of our members and on behalf of the banking industry, are asserting our rights as regulated financial institutions. And, you know, our perception of the rulemaking that Director Chopra orchestrated over a four-year period was that it was going to grow into a total leviathan, that he was going to extrapolate this very small statutory provision designed for a certain purpose to develop a labyrinth, a complex labyrinth that would attempt to regulate the entire ecosystem of permissioned customer data sharing. And we were ready for that. So we filed a lawsuit on the day the rule came out.
Around this time last year, right here on the stage at Money 2020, then Director Rohit Chopra, after introducing the rule, responded to your lawsuit by saying, quote, "I haven't read the lawsuit, and I don't think they've read the rule." When BPI and the Kentucky Bankers Association filed your legal challenge, what was actually in the filing? John, what was it about Section 1033 that your organization took issue with?
How much time do you have? No, I'm just kidding. First, with respect to Director Chopra, like, I appreciate what he said, which is he just released his rule and a lawsuit was filed immediately. That glosses over a lot of, like, complex strategy and tactics underlying it. I mean, the first point is we knew exactly what was going to be in that rule. That rule, it basically looks exactly like the proposal. And so to Director Chopra, to his credit, I think had been signaling all along what the rule was going to look like. In fact, the only major difference between the final rule and the proposed rule is that Director Chopra took the liberty to exempt from the rule's application banks with $850 million or less in assets, which is kind of interesting when you think about that, because if the consumer is supposed to own their data, is that it's only consumers of larger banking institutions? And if you bank with a small institution, you don't own your data. So it was just kind of interesting that he did that. But otherwise, the final rule was totally identical to the proposal. And so we were obviously well-positioned and well-informed and well-prepared to file the lawsuit. So I suspect after he read the lawsuit, he also was better informed.
Give us a quick summary. What exactly did you include in that filing? What were the highlighted issues?
Yeah. Again, I think broadly speaking, our view of the rule that he developed is that it replaced a very well-functioning, market-driven, customer permission data sharing ecosystem. I know that's a lot of words. But replaced that with what we thought was a complicated, costly, fundamentally insecure, mandated data sharing framework. So, like, how? Like, one, the rule mandated that banks share seemingly with any third party or data broker or data middleman sensitive customer financial information. Two, the rule forces banks to oversee those third parties and take responsibility for their security practices, but at the same time limits the ability of the bank to identify certain third parties that might be too risky and not share the data with them. So you're effectively forcing the banks to give data to people who they don't trust to handle the data. Three, it's outsourced, effectively binding legal constraints or restrictions on banks. It effectively outsourced that to these so-called standard setter organizations, which we thought was just the wrong way to do it. Fourth, it set these very vague standards for how the banks would be judged with respect to these developer interfaces that they do use to hook into the fintechs. Fifth, we thought the compliance deadlines were just totally unreasonable. And sixth, and I think this has got a lot of attention recently, the rule absolutely flatly prohibited banks from being able to charge any kind of fee in connection with the provision of this data to the fintechs.
So on October 22nd, 2024, the rule is released. BPI files the lawsuit the same day. Then, moving ahead, in November, Donald Trump is elected president for the second time. And throughout the beginning of 2025, the CFPB undergoes significant changes, with almost 90% of their staff being let go. Meanwhile, the 1033 litigation keeps going. Penny, how did the FTA come to intervene?
Yeah, so just a couple of points on that, just to kind of go back, and it goes back to the original, and in what the Dodd-Frank Section 1033, and I feel like we're back in Washington citing all these rules and regulations, but what it said was that, I'm paraphrasing, banks shall provide to a consumer their financial information upon request. And so that was part of what we thought that we had seen, inconsistent data sharing, that there needed to be rules of the road. As we were here debating today, we were both interpreting it in very different ways. And so we felt that the rule, and one of the things we were supportive of, was to put clarity around and to put certainty of what it means to define consumer, what it means to define upon request, what does it mean to define financial information. As we look around here at Money 2020, all this innovation that we're seeing here really can be pinned back to the data portability and the ability for so much of this innovation that relies on the data or uses the data to be able to enhance and share and build personalized consumer products that are helping them live a better financial life. So Rohit Chopra announced the final rule at the Philadelphia Fed FinTech Conference, I think at 10 in the morning. By 6 at night, BPI had filed the lawsuit. We all had to go to dinner that night. We were all invited to dinner that night, and there was a round of toasts that had to be done. So it was quite an interesting scene for Rohit Chopra to stand up and give a toast to the president of the Philly Fed. Then BPI gives a toast to the Philadelphia Fed. Then Philadelphia Fed goes, and then we go. So it was like this kind of really interesting mix of frenemies, enemies, people that were just right then and there. You know, he was very much surprised by the speed of which this lawsuit came. So fast forward it, once the lawsuit was filed, we took a close look at it and took a close look at what the claims were. And some of the concerns were that, one, in the initial claim, that the CFPB didn't even have the right or the statutory authority to be able to even promulgate this rule. Two, a definition of consumer that required a fiduciary responsibility. Three, upon request didn't mean that you just had to make it available, but yet no fees could be charged. And so there was a whole host, and there were severability claims within the lawsuit as well, that we were worried and started, as we looked at it more and more, they were filed in Kentucky in what I would consider a friendly court. And so worried that if they were to prevail on certain portions or to certain aspects, it would really set the fintech industry and the incredible amount of innovation that is occurring, really set it back if they were to win on certain things. So we started to look whether or not to file a motion to intervene, because we felt we had a unique voice. We weren't the bureau, and there were certain things, and still are certain things, in that rule or final law or effective law, whatever. You know, it's kind of in a little bit of ambiguity as to where the status of that sits. There was things that we didn't like in that rule, and so we wanted to bring a different voice and an additive voice into the conversation before the courts. Then, when the Trump administration announced that they would not be enforcing or getting rid of a whole swath, it wasn't just the 1033 rule that they, you know, said that they were not going to defend. There was a whole swath. But in particular for that one, we then filed the motion to intervene to have someone, especially on the point that consumers have the right to own and permission their data, that voice, somebody was able to be in court to defend that position.
Because the CFPB had, in fact, vacated their own...
Not yet. Not at that point. Not in February. They did not vacate until May. So at that point, they just had announced, when they appointed acting director Vogt, that they would not be defending or enforcing rules that had been promulgated in the prior administration.
And then what happened in May?
So in May, and John's the lawyer here and can probably walk through the timeline just slightly better than I can, but in May, BPI's initial filing was due. At the same time, CFPB was as well. At that point, well, actually, I'll step back. BPI filed. We were then granted a motion to intervene. We then became the intervener defender. And CFPB then, in their filing, decided to vacate and said in their vacating motion that certain parts of this rule were unlawful and therefore they must vacate their position. Fast forward 30 days later, we file our motion for summary judgment, refuting many of the claims that were in BPI's. And then 2 weeks later, a market-changing announcement was made, or not, I don't know if that it was made, but it was disclosed in the press that JP Morgan Chase decided to then charge fees at an astronomical level to data aggregators.
We'll come back to the JP Morgan news.
AO, can I just interrupt here? It's entirely appropriate that the Financial Technology Association sought to intervene in this case.
And BPI didn't challenge that.
Didn't challenge it. So, I mean, I think the writing was on the wall that this administration's CFPB was highly unlikely to rubber stamp some of what I consider to be the most overly government interventionalist policies and rulemakings coming out of the Biden administration. And this one was the poster child for that. And I think if you support open banking, if you support a safe and secure environment where the rights and benefits for the customer are paramount, then this is not your rule. This rule, in our view, will decimate the innovative, growing, evolving, well-functioning data sharing ecosystem that's developing it. And that's why we challenged it.
Yeah, and I would just say we obviously have a diabolically different viewpoint than that, in that we feel that you need to have that certainty and that clarity of what these definitional issues are to ensure this healthy ecosystem continues. I remember just 2 years ago, without this rule in place, I get a notice from Wells Fargo that says my Venmo account is now disconnected because I use Plaid, and that the only way it can be reconnected is to go through Akoya, which is a bank-owned data aggregator. So you were starting to see, you know, yes, the ecosystem has had incredible growth, and we've seen incredible amounts of innovation, but we were also starting to see data pools that were stale, that were untimely, a lot of different things that, again, without the clear interpretation so everybody understands what these rules of the road are, left to their own, we were starting to see some real anti-competitive behavior.
Yeah. As someone who represents a very highly regulated industry, I can just tell you, in our experience, there is nothing worse than baking into law. And that is what a regulation is. It is an enforceable law. There is nothing worse than baking into regulation and law these hyper-prescriptive requirements, particularly in an area like this, which is moving so fast every day. And you talk about, like, looking around this conference today. I mean, look at all the thousands of people here, all these innovators. Do you really want a thick spider web of Rohit Chopra's view of the data sharing ecosystem to envelop you and wrap your business model? I mean, is that what people want?
You're clearly both itching to get into what this fight is really about, which is great. Let's do it. You both find yourself in court on either side of this. So let's start to dig in. John, in your lawsuit, you put a lot of focus on a single word, consumer. You argue that Section 1033 only requires banks to share data with the consumer themselves, not with third parties acting as the consumer's representative, another important word. But consumers already authorize accountants, financial advisors, and tax lawyers to access their financial data. What makes this case different?
So legally, there's a difference and a distinction, and I'm happy to get into it. Practically, there's really not, right? Banks are more than happy to share their customers' data with third parties, fintechs, data aggregators, data middlemen, more than happy to do that in a safe, permissioned, informed consent kind of way. And that's what's happening in the marketplace today. Your question really is a legal question more than anything, which is, in 2010, what did Congress mean when they said that banks must share customer data with the consumer or their agent, trustee, or representative? That's kind of what the fight is about. It's an important fight, right? It's a legal distinction, but a distinction with a huge difference, right? Because this is what Rohit Chopra hung his entire 1033 open banking ecosystem micromanagement rule on was the fact that the statute says, oh, but it says here the banks have to share with the consumer or their agent, trustee, or representative. And Chopra was like, well, representative means any third party, so let's get to writing the rule. But if you go back and look at the statute, I mean, our view is the legal distinction here, which is why I think we should remove the hook on which the current rule is hung, is that A, it's the consumer, that's the individual, right? Okay, so you have to give it to the individual. B, you have to give it to their agent or trustee. Those are legally defined terms. Those are terms under the law that require those individuals to put the customer's interest well above their own, right? So there are these quote unquote fiduciary duties to the customer that an agent and a trustee by law have to require. But then the question is like, well, what does it mean representative? That sounds like less, right? That could just be like someone who shows up and says, hey, I'm Joe Smith's representative. I'm sort of here. But even when they do that, a representative, they're like acting on behalf of the consumer, right? And when you're talking about, oh, this is my representative to pick up my McDonald's, right? If your Uber Eats guy is getting your McDonald's and bringing it to you, that's probably a lower standard. But if it's someone showing up to your bank and saying, I would like all of the information on customer X, I would like all the data on that person, that's a different type of thing. And so in our view, representative in that context means someone who is prizing the customer and prizing the customer's data and their security and how that information is going to be used. So that's why it's a distinction with a difference. It doesn't mean any third party. And by the way, again, that doesn't mean banks won't share information with third parties and all these fintechs, but it just means that those fintechs don't have a right by statute to it.
Penny, I'd like to give you an opportunity to respond. John mentioned this notion of congressional intent. BPI argues that Congress never intended for Section 1033 to create open banking. It was simply meant to ensure consumers could see their own transactions. They argue that Congress only ever intended to help Americans be better informed consumers, not to create a full-blown data-sharing ecosystem. How do you respond?
Well, if you look at the language that Congress put into the act, it says that banks must share or shall share consumers' financial information upon request. So right there, in and of itself, the language that is there, it shall provide this information. So it wasn't limited. It wasn't just this small piece so that you can change banks. It was to be able to share the full, complete picture of what the consumer is. Because remember, at the time, again, it was in response to the financial crisis that the Dodd-Frank Act came into being. And it was to make sure that those consumers, in reaction to the mortgage crisis, they didn't necessarily have an understanding of some of the mortgages and the liabilities in which they had. And so they wanted to ensure that consumers have that full understanding of what their financial picture is and to be able to share it. And as John rightly says, agent, representative, or trustee. But nowhere in that definition of those does it say fiduciary. Does it say fiduciary representative? It doesn't say that you have to have a financial representative. It doesn't define it in that way. And so that's where we would disagree on that. And was it fiduciary or fiduciary? Like, it just isn't there in that text. Obviously, Rohit Chopra interpreted it in a way that says it doesn't require it. And that's now before the CFPB to make that determination on whether or not, you know, maybe whose side is right on what that definition is.
Another issue that's been raised is this concept of screen scraping. One of BPI's most pointed criticisms is that the rule doesn't ban screen scraping, a practice where consumers give their bank credentials to third parties. John, you call this an unsafe practice that the CFPB itself acknowledged as risky. Do you think that screen scraping should be banned outright?
Short answer is yes. Longer answer is I'm sort of here not arguing for a government interventionalist approach. But the bottom line is screen scraping is risky for customers, puts customers' data in peril. It's not a good practice. It's not a responsible practice. It shouldn't be occurring in the ecosystem at all. Probably a position I assume Penny agrees with.
Agree. This is a place we can agree on, is that there should be a transition out of screen scraping, and the rule that, in which was promulgated, did allow for that. And we are supportive of that because we want to ensure that the consumers' data is safe, that it is shared in a secure way, that it has ways in which to not only be permissioned, but also revoked at any point. And so the API, the shift into APIs is a safer method. And, you know, there are smaller institutions that, you know, did through their own comment letters through the last iteration of this rulemaking, asked for some type of phasing into. So supportive, understand there's probably going to need to be a firm date at some point. And, you know, we have argued in our own that the movement to API does create a secure system.
Another thorny issue is capital L liability. John, you argue that based on the current rule, banks are left holding the bag when fintechs fail to protect data. Penny, should fintechs bear liability for data breaches? And if so, why doesn't the FTA push for explicit liability provisions in the rule?
But we do, and we believe that liability moves with the data. And we should leverage existing safeguards, GLBA, the FTC's safeguards, the Unfair Deceptive Practices Act, OFAC, and NIST, and all kinds of different standards about how to securely move, share, and what that liability and what that responsibility is as the data moves. So we do argue in our, or we do put forth in our own comment letter that it should be addressed, but we can leverage and harmonize against existing security and data standards that are currently within us.
John, I presume this is another point of agreement.
Yeah, absolutely. There should be maximum clarity about the liability apportionment when something goes wrong. And, you know, there are these principles in law that you should make the person who's liable for a wrong, you should assign that responsibility to the person who's in the best position to prevent it. And here, this is an excellent case of that. I mean, if you have third parties that are taking sensitive customer data from the customer's bank and then housing it and using it, that's fine, right? If that's what the customer wants. But those entities need to be liable if something goes wrong. That can't fall back to the bank. Why? Because they possess the ability, they control the environment in their company, and so they're best positioned to adopt the type of mitigation and prophylactics necessary to keep the bad actors out.
I promised we would get back to fees for data access, and here we are. The next chapter in this saga happened in July, when Bloomberg released a report that JP Morgan was going to start charging fintechs and their aggregators for access to customers' data, a move in direct violation of Section 1033, which clearly states that data access must be free. John, you've accused fintechs of free-riding off of the bank's secure infrastructure that they've invested in. Penny, you have argued that fees are not only anti-competitive, but wrong, putting a price on something that ultimately belongs not to the banks, but to their customers. Your thoughts on whether or not banks should be able to charge for data access?
I can start. Look, my view on the fees, we've been in the midst of a pearl-clutching moment on this one, right? A lot of, like, aghast reactions and such. I think, and I don't mean to minimize that, right? But I think that's going to pass, right? I think it's already passed a little bit. Those who were sort of most offended at the time are now those who have inked agreements, agreeing to pay fees, right? And I think the, like, quote unquote, exorbitant nature of the fees, I think, like, people are realizing was totally overblown. But, you know, I don't know. We're still at the sort of the infancy of this phase of the ecosystem's development. But I think fees will clearly develop into the ecosystem. And I think it's something that is just going to be a commercial term to be negotiated, right? And those negotiations are happening and will continue to happen. It did seem like I understand where the FTA comes from on the fees, which is, you know, to date in the development of the ecosystem, people didn't have to contend with the fees as much. I think the banking industry always reserved the right to build fees into the ecosystem at some point. But the banking industry recognized that the development of the industry and the innovations around it needed to mature before you could start to figure out how to develop market-based pricing mechanisms. And by the way, it goes to everything. It goes to liability. It goes to risk. It just builds the proper incentive structure, again, in a capitalist society. I mean, if we want to live in a different kind of society where, like, commercial parties can't negotiate terms amongst themselves. I guess that's a bigger question. But I think when we talk about like America and capitalism and how this country is the incubator of most of the good and innovative ideas coming out, including in the payment space, I think that's what we want to do. We want to empower private industry and not have government price fixing.
Penny, your response?
We have argued in court and in our own filings that the statute is clear that banks shall make this information available upon request. It doesn't say upon request for a fee. It doesn't stipulate that you can charge. It says just upon request, shall make available upon request. And that is a key aspect, and it was agreed upon. You know, obviously the past administration agreed and put into their own law, you know, a prohibition about it as well. You should not be charging for a statutory requirement. And that's what that is. There's a statutory requirement that says every year you have to send out a privacy announcement. They're not charging for that. That is just part of a statutory obligation to do. And so you think about that now and translate it. Yes, there has been an agreement between two major players, both from a bank side and a data aggregator side. But if you also read the comment letters from that data aggregator, they will also affirm that, yes, they agree to this because they didn't want disruption into the ecosystem. And they wanted to make sure that innovation was continued. However, they also believe statutorily that fees are not allowed. And so that's really kind of what will need to be decided as well. And we think that the rule and the law is on the side of no fees, and look forward to vigorously defending that. Because, you know, that is, you know, if you now think, especially in this world that we're moving into very, very quickly with digital assets and stable coins and others, if you're moving, you know, the connectivity for you to move your information into a crypto wallet to be able to move from fiat to crypto, if there is a $10 plus whatever fee it is that is being assessed, you know, that innovation is just going to shrink. And so it was interesting to see that, you know, for, as John alluded to, for years, for better part of 10 years, this system had existed without the fees. And the first hint of regulation uncertainty, an announcement went out for exorbitant fees to be charged against it. So that in and of itself is another reason to have this clarity to ensure anti-competitive behavior doesn't enter into the marketplace.
So I would simply say banks do make customer data available to their customers for free, right? And so I think the question is a third party fintech the customer? And this is where we just disagree on the law.
Let's move on. We already heard how in May, the CFPB asked to vacate its own rule, leading to the FTA intervening. But then in July, after the JP Morgan news, it reversed again, saying it would revise rather than kill the rule based on an accelerated timeline. In fact, they've already issued an advance notice of proposed rulemaking, an ANPR, which received over 14,000 responses before the comment period ended just a few days ago, on October 21st. What happens now? Can a short-staffed CFPB really deliver a meaningful revision of 1033, let alone in weeks instead of years?
We believe that we take the administration at its word and that they are committed to promulgating a final rule. We obviously don't know what the final rule is going to look like. That is for the regulators to decide. We have all made our comments known. They are public. Everybody can, I would highly suggest a Claude or a ChatGPT if you want to do a quick summary of going through the 14,000 letters. But that's what's before them. And so, yes, I do believe this administration has the capacity and they also have the motivation to promulgate a rule in which they see addresses these key issues.
Sure, absolutely. But listen, my view, I think BPI's view, is that these issues are commercial term issues that should be worked out in the marketplace. You know, having the government write a regulation in this space, we think is a mistake. There is clear statutory authority for the CFPB to do something around, like, you know, the formats in which data should be shared. But as a general matter, you know, the market is working. The customer is critical. That's how the banks see it. The customer data security is paramount. And the ecosystem should work out a few things. It should be very clear that the consumers are in control of their data with clear consent, transparency around data usage, and the ability for the consumer to revoke. Third-party use should be limited to things that directly benefit the consumer. They should be limited to the specific product and service that the customer wants, and that the fintech should seek reauthorization from the customer on a regular basis. With respect to the third-party limitations on them, there should be no selling of the customer data beyond what the customer signed up for. There should be no screen scraping. There should be robust data security for the fintechs, including allowing the banks to look at them and to comply with their third-party risk management obligations. And there should be reciprocity, by the way, between banks and non-banks. Non-banks should be providing this information to the banks just the way the banks are providing it to them. And there should be market-based rates that should be allowed to be charged with a clear liability regime. The marketplace is far better off deciding all of these terms on its own through negotiation of commercial terms than turning to the government for some solution that, again, I think is just going to make the market less innovative, less resilient, and will not advance the interests of the consumer.
There's an assumption in this debate that banks and fintechs are locked in a zero-sum competition. One side wins and the other loses. Is that actually true, or is there a version of open banking where both sectors thrive and consumers genuinely benefit? What would that look like?
I just want to go back real quick to just what John just said, in that the irony is that the final rule that was promulgated in 2024 did actually put in place those security placements about how third parties can share, how they have access, what kind of data they have access, the revocability of a consumer. So all of those safety and security measures that he says wants to be in place, it actually is in place. Obviously, they filed a lawsuit against that. So there is protection. We all agree on that. But I would say that the rub is on the marketplace. And what we've seen, unfortunately, is that without these clear rules and without the standards in place that need to take place about the portability of this data and the ownership of it, you have a marketplace that we saw at the first hint of uncertainty, they were going to charge rates that were prohibitive. And so that's why you need the clarity. That's why you need this access. And to your second point on banks, we have a lot of banks, you know, chartered entities in our own fintechs that have charters and are now considered to be a bank. They're excited about this and they welcome open banking because it is a two-way street. It's not just provider going out. What they're getting in return is enhanced data for them to be able to make better decisions to the consumer. So you have a lot of banks, especially smaller institutions and others, that are very excited and want these clear rules to be able to share and own and have a more robust ecosystem.
I agree, it's not a zero-sum game. The customer is first and is paramount and should drive everything. The fintechs know that. That's why they're developing all these innovative products and services that they know the customers want. The banks are going to play along as well. They're certainly not going to try to build moats or walls. I think this canard of exorbitant fees is not going to be anything anybody talks about in a month. And so, no, it's this. If you get the government out of this and let the marketplace continue to develop on its own, that's going to be the best outcome.
When it comes down to it, it seems like your two positions may be closer to each other than many people think. Let's close with a simple question. On behalf of your respective organizations, are you for open banking?
Absolutely, 100%.
Absolutely.
John, Penny, thank you for an outstanding conversation. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you, Hale.
At the time of this recording, in early 2026, Section 1033 remains in limbo. There is no enforcement of its provisions. All compliance deadlines are stayed, and the revisions promised by the new leadership of the CFPB are not forthcoming, at least not yet. The Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, or NPRM, is still being written. Section 1033 is effectively frozen. On the other hand, a rule that many thought would die continues to live. It was abandoned by its own regulator, deferred by an unfriendly court, and violated by the world's largest bank. And yet, it survives. Section 1033, it seems, won't go away. At the center of the action, the court case between John and his team at BPI, acting as plaintiffs, and Penny and her team at FTA, acting as interveners, continues to roll on. In fact, the case has now caught the attention of open banking practitioners the world over, well beyond the borders of the United States. As you've heard, the two sides disagree on many things. On the definition of representative, and whether that representative has a fiduciary responsibility. On the question of congressional intent, and whether Section 1033 is really a valid basis for open banking. And crucially, on the issue of charging fees for data access. Should the government force data to be shared for free? Or should the market determine the cost? Their disagreements are well known. Less so, the subjects on which they agree. Both sides understand that screen scraping, where customers share their credentials, is dangerous and costly, and both advocate for its eventual demise. Both sides believe liability should follow the data, rather than leaving the banks holding the bag for every possible fintech out there. Most important of all, both sides agree on one fundamental idea: that open banking makes sense, that it works, that providing consumers with a secure, reliable, trustworthy way to share their data will make their lives better. Lawsuits may linger, deadlines may be delayed, but open banking is here to stay.
Thanks for listening to Mr. Open Banking, the podcast that explores the ongoing evolution of open banking and its impact on our lives. Make no mistake, the rise of open banking is going to change financial services forever, and we will be covering that story every step of the way. This is your host, A.L. Savan. Until next time.
This episode of Mr. Open Banking was made possible by FData, the Financial Data and Technology Association, advocating for open finance across North America and around the world. To learn more, join FData's Global Open Finance Summit and visit fdata.global.